again. Did you miss us? Did you forget about us? Because it's been a really long time since we have checked in and talked about Animorphs. We are excited to be back, and we hope that you have stuck around and are going to hear our thoughts about Visser, perhaps. Well, perhaps you're going to hear. We're definitely talking about Visser. We left off in the Animorphs roundup in the normal book flow, and now we've sort of jettisoned off into one of the special Megamorphs?
It's a Chronicles.
Thank you.
It just doesn't happen to be called the Visser Chronicles, and I'm not sure why.
That is... of any of them, this was the most chronically of all.
It's literally a chronicle, and it has two Vissers.
Exactly. The opportunity missed. So that is the idea behind this book, in that the Andalite Chronicles gives the background of Visser III, and a little bit Elfanger as well, which we just found out when we were Wikipedia-ing pronunciations that K.A. herself has said that it's pronounced Elfangor, which...
we apologize for mispronouncing Elfanger's name and for continuing to do so.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I'm not changing.
It's been too long. So yes, humble apologies for blatant mispronunciation. But that's the joy of reading. It always sounds different in your head. Anyways, so in the Andalite Chronicles was a chronicle of that story of how Visser III became Visser III. This is the story of how Visser I became Visser I, which has a little more of an emotional tether because we know that Visser I's host is Marco's mom. And it literally is a chronicle. The book is constructed in a way that Visser I has to give her testimony so that she isn't executed. Basically, the structure is that Visser I and Visser III are both on trial for treason.
Multiple treasonous charges. Apparently anything that you do in the Yurk Empire will get you killed.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So
whether or not you work for them.
Yeah, basically. So they're both on charges of treason, and the Council of 13 is hearing their testimony. And so it is sort of a manifestation of the dynamic that we've always gotten glimpses of with Visser I and Visser III, which is that they're very much at odds, and they're very much... they have different fighting styles, and they both are trying to one-up each other and outdo each other and manipulate each other at every turn. And so that definitely is, like, running through the testimony. And at first, it starts out, you know, and you're like, oh, they're just, like, Visser I's just telling a story, and we're just in a room and telling a story.
Yeah, it's a little... dry at first, because there's a few interjections from Visser III when he thinks that she's lying, or when he's trying to make a point to the people who are judging them as to all her terrible things, or occasionally one of the council members will say something, but it is really just like her saying XYZ things happened,
yeah,
like in this order.
Yeah, and luckily it did, they introduced like live memory.
Yeah, there's a plot device that's basically a pensive.
Yeah.
Called a memory dump.
Yeah.
Which apparently is
pretty
standard Yurk operating practice, like for lower ranking intelligence and military figures, like, I guess, to keep them on the straight and narrow.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get to a certain point, it's like, all right, we don't need to know anymore about all the ways you're breaking the law. And that's literally what they say. Like, at one point, I think every character is like, yeah, we accept that, like, you are literally breaking all of our laws in the course of viscering, basically.
Yeah. Well, sure.
And politicians?
Yeah, basically. Well, and then it does also expand a little bit in real time. Story sort of happens in real time. So it's not just like, oh, this is backstory and exposition. Which is the first part kind of needed to be to catch us up, because we don't know anything about Visser I previously. With the Andalite Chronicles with Visser III, we had a little bit of a door into that story, and the characters in that story we were familiar with anyways, like Alarin and Elfanger's in that story also. And so, like, we have some sort of compass to, like, guide us, whereas
right.
With Visser I, we were kind of going in a blank slate.
It's like, all you know is that Eva, her host body, is Marco's mother, and, like, that's the emotional hook. And then that she's overseen the invasion of Earth, and Visser III hates her, and, like,
yeah,
that's the political hook.
Yeah, basically.
That's it. Everything else is pretty much brand new information.
Yeah. So we'll go into that information now. So Visor 1 is Idris. We're making an attempt to pronounce that correctly. You might say Idris or Edris. We might say that too. But we're thinking that because it has a double S at the end, and other Yerk names seem to have that.
Yeah, pattern. There's a lot of, as I recall, there's more that it's like a repeat sibilant. So it might be just a function of their language or what KA wants their language to sound like.
The hissing sounds evil. Exactly. So your Visor 1 is a Yerk named Idris, which they don't really make a point about the fact that Idris is a female Yerk. Yes? Yerks have genders?
Yes.
I say that
like that because honestly, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm unsure how... Because later on in the book, presumably Visor 3, someone points out that you don't need human bodies to procreate, all species procreate in some way, and that Yerks die after they split to make new Yerks. So yeah, I mean, is Idris female in an Earth sense?
I have assumed.
I mean, have we just been assuming all the time that Yerks who infest male humans are male Yerks and vice versa?
I think we have been assuming that.
This is terrible!
Yes. Well, it's interesting, though, because I think that the... I don't know. The differences between Visor 3 and Visor 1 are interesting in terms of, like, Earth-human gender norms, because Visor 3 is kind of calamitous and...
Yeah, he has a scary host body. He has an Andalite. He's the only Andalite controller. He's deadly. He has deadly morphs. Mm. Like, he is physically threatening. Mm. And
he's
Eva,
also kind of a baby.
Eva has been described, and he is a giant man baby.
Mr. Man baby.
And yeah, Eva's human, and she's human female, and she's a non-white human female that we know. She's Latina, and she's been described in books past as being, like, slight, you know, small, not physically imposing.
Mm.
So...
Yeah. And she's... I think it mirrors as well with their different tactics that she's been more manipulative and more...
Sure.
She plays the long game and she does things in a more subtle fashion and more psychological than going in and stomping all over everything and eating people. Which, in the beginning, Visor 3 is like, they brought up, like, Elfanger, and he's like, he's not here, I ate him.
And he literally says, like, I picked him up and ate him. I'm like, yeah, we know.
Yeah.
Also, are you bragging about that? Of course you're bragging about that.
Yeah.
As, like, proof that you're effective and Visor 1 is not effective.
Don't worry, guys, I ate him.
He's taken care of, man. He's been consumed.
Yeah. And we find out that, you know, they've both spearheaded the invasion of Earth at one point, and that's kind of the same way as their strategies. We find out that, I mean, Visor 3's strategy is very, like, boorish and stompy, and, like, we're going to blow things up. And Idris's strategy as Visor 1 is sort of infiltration. Like, she creates the sharing.
Yes, and even the twist that comes up later is... gendered in a way that she would want to be a mother, that she has maternal instincts, that she was willing to, like, collaborate to that extent with a host species, which is high treason, of course, in the Yerk Empire on a couple of levels, I think. And it's indicated that she knows humans really well. She is addicted to humans.
Oof.
You know, that whole thread in Visor 3 is consistently, like, he doesn't know anything about humans. He doesn't know how to use them or utilize Earth properly. He keeps getting his ass kicked by Earth specifically in terms of the Animorphs themselves. And so that's why he's ineffective.
Yeah.
It's because he refuses to learn anything about them.
He's also
not hanging out with them.
He's also not a human controller, though. That
yeah.
is a huge advantage if you go into a human head. Like, when Idris first gets to Earth, she's the first Yerk to ever get to Earth. She's the first Yerk to ever infest anyone, which is kind of like a big deal. For me, that was a big revelation that, again, not knowing anything about Visor 1 coming in, it was like, oh shit, she created the sharing. She was the first person, the first Yerk on Earth. She was the first Yerk to be a human controller. She was the first Yerk to, like, understand humans. Like, she really kicked this off. You know, and we, in terms of origin stories, for the Animorphs sort of as a series, it's like, okay, well, yes, like, Elfanger giving him the morphing power. Okay, yes, like, I don't know, Visser 3, like, becoming Visser 3 so that he can attack Earth. But, like, really, we're at the origin of the origins now, where it's like, no, like, Idris is the first one to see the potential in humans.
To Yerkes, she and Assam are, like, the vanguard for, like, the entire invasion, when they didn't even know if it was going to happen.
Yeah.
When they were still trying to figure out, literally, if, like, humans were the perfect host species. Like, they were just, like, the advance party to, like, to see.
Yeah.
And then everything just sort of snowballed because, oh, actually, yeah, they are perfect.
Yeah. But it also created such an interesting, like, dichotomy because they do understand humans, because they lived as humans, and then things got real messy real fast.
And everything just got totally out of hand. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the main point of treason that Idris is charged with is basically just loving humans too much. Basically defecting and being more human than Yerk.
Not even, like, collaboration, like, defection.
Yeah. And for me, it was interesting to watch Idris sort of vacillate between being very Yerk and very human. And I was sort of paying attention to it in a way where it was along the lines of, does this feel organic? Does it make sense? Or does it feel authentic, you know, that she could swing so quickly between threatening Eva and being really condescending to her and then collaborating with Eva and being like, well, like, you're a mother too. I know you understand, kind of thing. Which, you know, your mileage may vary, but I think that definitely there is a point in the fact that, it's not black and white, and a lot of the Yerkes that we've encountered in the past that have sort of broken the mold of, like, quote-unquote evil haven't been so torn. I think we were first introduced to Yerkes that were like, no, we're not evil, and it sucks, and we're, like, pretty much on your side. And then there are the evil ones, and then Idris is kind of just tragically both.
Yeah, and tragically, I think, is the operative word, because, like, the whole way through, especially once you find out about, like, Alice and Kim, all you can think about is, like, you know, like, but what if this had worked? Like, what if they had just become, like, symbiotes? And what if she had been okay with trying to make that the point, instead of, like, still trying to cling to what her original goal was and, like, serve the Empire and, you know, do what she thought she was supposed to do and not... Because even when she's living for those 2 years, like, as a human, as a symbiote with humans and her two husbands, she still's like, oh yeah, man, I was, like, obsessed, like, and that was how it was, but there was always her assumption that she was going to get back on track. It was never like, oh, now I have a new goal. Like, this is how it should be, this is how it could be, this is what we should be trying to do as a people.
A level of delusion.
And so it's
just
really sad. It's like... Oh, you were so close.
Yeah.
Well, this entire book series not existing.
Well, and for me, the fact that the lines were so blurred between host and Yerk was part of what was so, like, tragic and messed up and, like, made me cringe in, like, the best possible way, like, to be reading it and just go, like, oh, like, this is not healthy. Like, this is not healthy.
Yeah, because, like, when Assam dies of Kendrona starvation inside Hildy's head, part of him remains. Like, and so, you know, at that point, the way that the four of them had developed together, like, I mean, obviously it fucked Hildy up. And we've seen this before in other Animorphs books. Like, if you've been infested and for whatever reason you are freed without your host body being killed... Like, you usually, things don't turn out well because everyone thinks you're insane. Mm-hmm. So you become homeless, you know, you go into an asylum, something happens that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's obvious, but for this character, I had to assume that part of it was because, like, he couldn't function anymore without the Yerk.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, missed him.
Well, that's also part of it, is that...
those two especially had been, like, more partner-like, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and that Assam, we've... not done a great job giving backstory on all of these people already just been talking about us. So we hope you read it recently and you're just, like, right there with us.
Or you can read the Wikipedia page.
That's
it's pretty,
true.
It's pretty in-depth.
That's true. Go read the Wikipedia page. Assam was a Yerk pilot that was engineer pilot that was chosen by Idris to like steal a ship and go to Earth to go or to go find Earth to find this like possible class five like species or whatever. And she specifically chose him because he lacked purpose and he was kind of a little bit spineless. He was written up for not taking the right action. Like, he accidentally let some Horcruxes go free or something at one point. Like, he did something real stupid and dopey that, like, as a reader, you're like, oh, buddy, like, you're just a pilot. And that was why, like, Idris wanted, like, a servant.
And, yeah.
Which is also fucked up that, like, they fell in love and also their hosts were in love and, like, it was real.
Yeah,
I was getting, like, the heebie-jeebies at
that section. I was reading it and going,
y'all need therapy.
This is unclear.
Yeah, it's
and, like,
really
not in a bad, like, writing way, but like, very purposeful and, like, K.A. wants, because we figured out that K.A. wrote this. She
yes.
wants you to be uncomfortable. She wants
you
to be unsure of how this works because, it's messed up.
It's messed up. I mean, when you do, like, when you put the Yurk and the human name together, it was just a slash between them to be like, yes, that's them. Like, this one entity that's both of these things, a parasite and a host. And they're all raising children together. Like, it's a strange interspecies polyamory relationship in a very messed up way. Like, not in an ideal way.
And, yeah, it's sad because, like, there's always flickers of that it could have been okay.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, if everybody was, like, in agreeance on the fact that they were going to, you know, share this body and these minds and raise these kids and presumably at some point, in fact, infest them with Yurk, because I was unclear about that.
Yeah.
Because that was sort of, like, that was what Mr. One said was the plan.
There was one point, though, where she said, well, I think there was one point where she kind of made it seem like that was not a thing she wanted.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously, instead of killing the children, which is what a good Yurk would have done, aside from not having them in the first place.
Yes.
They let them be adopted, which is, like, a very human and, you know, obviously it's the route that you take if you don't want to have to kill your children.
Yeah. God.
And so, you know, you can extrapolate that she would not have wanted them to be infested either, but it's still an interesting thought experiment. Like, the Yurk human family, like, at some point your kids cannot just be human, like, they have to be Yurk too.
Yes.
If you want the experiment to continue.
Yeah, the transparency, basically.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing as well, is that, I mean, inherently, like, their power, and then part of why this is, like, squicky is that their power imbalances inherently in host and parasite, and then in, as well, in the relationship between Idris and Assam, and it makes for really effed up relationships when there's such a clear power imbalance. Because, I mean, Hildy and Allison don't really consent. And Allison in particular, we don't get a lot from her point of view, and I wish that we had. Especially because Idris, like, made such a big deal about Allison, because Allison was the first competent human host that she had, and she respected Allison. And for a little while, I was like, was she also in love with Allison, in addition to Assam and Hildy? Like, was it just, like, one big, happy family? But we didn't really get much from Allison's point of view.
And
that I would like.
Obviously, Idris is the ultimate unreliable narrator.
Mm.
And everything good, air quote, or admirable that she says about Allison in terms of, like, why she respected her is, I mean, it could just be projection.
Mm.
Like, oh, you know, Allison was a scientist. She had a scientist's mind. Like, she was more okay with this than other people would have been because it was scientific and it was interesting to her. And, like, it was an experiment and all this. And that was why, like, it worked.
Yeah.
It worked.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I mean, that may have been true, but ultimately, like, no. You have to be really hardcore for your science to be like, I'm going to surrender my free will just to see.
Yeah. Well, and there was this story, and it was pretty early in the infestation, I guess, but, like, Idris purposefully would turn off her control of certain body parts to see if Allison would pick up on it and if she would do anything about it. And she left the left eye alone. And then Allison, when they were driving, conveniently closed it so that they would get into a car accident and die. Which, like, Allison's a badass. Like,
yeah,
I wanted to know her more.
And later on, like, when they're talking about the children and them getting married, And it like flashes back to like when what Visser One perceived as being like the point at which Allison and Hildy fall in love. And like you could, you know, you see her like basically projecting that as the humans having control, because that is not an emotion that Yerkes feel.
Mm.
But ultimately it's like, is that this is not the path.
It's
like, come on.
So it's
you're
so
still physically in control.
Exactly. It's
you can make them do whatever you want.
It's such a blur.
And
line.
So like for there to suddenly be an influx of emotion that you, the Yerkes, are not familiar with and that you don't know how to control. I mean, yeah, you could say that that is a power on the human's part, but it's not something that humans can turn off and turn on.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just be like, I'm going to use the power of love now. It's like, it's not, it's not Sailor Moon, I'm sorry.
I wish it were. Well, and that's something that, when I got to the end of the book, I flipped back to the beginning and skimmed through the beginning again to sort of tie it all up. Because a lot of information that was given in the beginning was untethered, and after having read it, a lot of it in the beginning landed with me a little bit better because I sort of had a place to put the information. And that was something that I noticed when Idris infests the soldier at the beginning. The first thing that she comments about the human brain, it is two halves. And that's, like, really stupid. A human is of two minds all the time. And so I think that, like, echoes really nicely in what ends up happening to Idris, because that is exactly what happens. Like, she is human in Yerk, and
yeah.
It's completely
she says
both.
That, like, she perceived it, at the outset, she's like, oh, well, this is going to make it easier, because they're already fighting themselves pretty much all the time. Which, to be fair, is true.
It is true.
I'm always arguing with myself in my head about small things or big things.
Mm-hmm. Both.
But the way it ends up, it's like, no, that infected you. Like,
yeah.
It did.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it didn't really serve you.
No. No, and that's like a fun. It's an interesting element of the invasion of Earth that are humans the ideal host, or are humans the worst host? Because, you know, we're weak and walk on two legs, but free will, but compassion, but sacrifice, but cowardice, but all of these things that humans are. And the fact that humans war within one another, they mention that as well. Like, humans are fighting each other. Like, what dumbasses.
Yeah, that's a consistent thread in the Animorphs books, is that humans kill each other all the time.
Yeah.
As like an... It's used as like an outlier species indicator, like that, you know,
we're not civilized.
That, yeah, that Axe is like horrified in the time travel book by the Holocaust, you know, as he should be, obviously.
Rightfully.
But he's like just confused,
right?
Specifically about the killing of children.
Me too, Axe.
Yeah, like I also, buddy.
What's good to
cinnamon?
And
all the animals are like, now we're aware it's bad, but it still happens.
Yeah. A lot of like relevant Animorphs themes in this book.
Right. When I texted you while I was reading it, and I was like, this is going to be a super topical podcast, because, you know, it's the story of the invasion.
Mm.
It's the story of something growing inside of humanity, in this case, that has an element of control that humans are not aware of or are unable to resist. And so, you know,
I'm sorry, how is that topical? What are you talking about?
This week has been really strange politically.
Recently something
in terms of control, exterior control of, in our case, American society. Yeah, I was reading it and just going, oh, what? No. This is happening again.
Yeah.
If you told me that there were Yerkes on Earth, I would believe you right now.
Yeah.
Of course, this being set during Desert Storm, anything that, and, you know, Animorphs starting to come out in that time, like, you know, we were alive, but weren't really politically cognizant. So whenever I see media that involves the first Persian Gulf War, it's always interesting to me to think about the second Persian Gulf War that, for whatever reason, wasn't called that. and being, you know, coming of age post 9/11 and now arguably having the quarter life crisis that is currently happening.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this reread that we've been doing for post-college years,
mm-hmm.
a great time of political turmoil.
Yeah.
It's always, Animorphs is always reflective.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, I mean, I can never say enough how much I appreciate that it's a kid's book that keeps it real in terms of politics and humanity and, you know, nests everything, even though it's science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, it's very real world. Obviously, it's set. It's not second world speculative fiction necessarily, except when they go literally off world. But even, you know, the human stuff, even just beyond, like, verisimilitude of politics, just the way that they talk about humanity is always very a little too close.
Yeah, seriously. In a good way. We like it.
Yes. Yes.
Hurt is good.
It's depressing and enlightening.
Yeah. So eventually this book does tether into Marco and the gang. Basically, yeah, we do get our heroes in here. Basically, as the trial is happening, there are a couple power plays back and forth. One thing that Visser 3 does that's really stupid is he stages, like, a fake Andalite bandit attack so that he can kill the fake Andalite bandits and be like, haha, I have done it right here in front of you. What were the chances?
I have to assume that the Council 13 didn't fall for it anyway, and we're just like, this motherfucker, like, let's let this play out, because they are both grinding our nerves.
I have grown to love Visser 3 so much as a villain, because he's so ridiculous, and I love that, like, K.A. leans into his flaws and makes it there, because, you know, when you get, like, a book series, or when you extend a narrative so long, you have to ask the question, like, why hasn't the villain been successful? Like, why can the hero run through a flurry of bullets and not get shot, but, like, six villains get shot in the same scenario? Like, the reality of the situation is always going to sort of, like, creep in on your suspension of disbelief, or suspension of belief, that, you know, the villain would fail so many times, like... I mean, there's plenty of Harry Potter jokes and, like, Voldemort being foiled again by, like, some, like, really stupid thing at Hogwarts. But I love that K.A. acknowledges that and, like, creates a very flawed villain that's still terrifying and still an effective villain, but he is absurd and ridiculous and makes mistakes in a very, you know, obvious way.
Usually I enjoy Visser 3, like, as a villain, but, again, when I was reading Visser this time, I was, like, just watching him interact with Visser 1 and interact with the Council and all the his posturing and the weird, like, the power plays that he attempts, the way that he talks to her, it's just, like...
Does it remind you of somebody?
It does!
Who does it remind you?
I mean, and obviously, this is just, it's trenchant now, and it's impossible to avoid, and it's all we're all thinking about and just losing our shit over, but... Everything that Visser 3 tries is just so transparent and infuriating, and yet still somehow is effective. And, like,
damn it. I'm reading these books for an escape. Come on.
It just keeps leeching in.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's my own problem. It's just projection. But,
yeah, because
it's a good point. You know, he plays on
fears.
On
ego.
The fears that are commonly accepted in his own society. And blows them up to what should be an unrealistic extent, but which is accepted. And, yeah, giant ego, physical presentation, people that he surrounds himself with in terms of, like, lower, like, the lower rung of, obviously, how he talks about, like, lower rung, you know, their cannon fodder, their uses are X, Y, and Z, and that's it. Like,
yeah. Manipulation and brutishness at the same time.
Yeah,
all those things.
He's obnoxious.
He is obnoxious. It's true. It is true.
Every time he talked, I was like, man, shut up. Let Visser 1 talk. She's talking. Which is not to say that I would vote for Visser 1, because I wouldn't.
We here are blurring our own lines between reality and fiction in this book.
Dude, speaking of reality versus fiction in this book, I had never really thought about this before in terms of the sharing, even though the sharing pops up all the time and it's pretty significant, and, like, we know that the way that it's used and what their covers are, but I'd still never really been like, oh, I mean, this is the real world analog. And in this book, for some reason, I don't know if Kay was intending it and was just, like, really leaning on it, but it reminded me of Scientology. Like, especially when, after Eva kills Lord David Altman as, like, the figurehead, and she's like, I left behind a number of mysterious writings and prophecies to let them play with. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely
she's good.
Scientology.
Yeah. No, I the...
And, like, the inner rung thing, like,
yes.
That was... I mean, if you've seen Going Clear, it's just like that.
Yeah. I enjoyed seeing how the, like, particulars of how she set up the sharing. And again, demonstrating her sort of difference of belief from Visser 3. Visser 3 just wants to annihilate the planet, and Visser 1 sees that humans are weak and want to, above all else, feel special and like they belong and that they're part of something larger than themselves.
Which, again, that's one of those things where it's like, you were so close
mm-hmm.
to like having this be...
Glee Club.
If feasible... a feasible plan of symbiosis rather than infestation.
Yeah.
Like, if you just edged a little bit off of your current path.
Yeah.
And tweaked your theology, basically, just a touch. Like, it wouldn't be totally awful.
Iron out the wrinkles.
Literally. Sink into the brain wrinkles. Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, Visser 3 just wants to... He thinks that you can take a society by force and terror, because that, you know, I was going to say that's how that's worked for other species they've taken, but that's not true. It's not true in any case, because each of the species is just, like, totally different. And then Visser 1, who I think is more correct, thinks that you can let people do most of the work themselves.
Yeah.
Which is usually the case.
Yeah.
So.
Which is also the scary thing.
Yeah. As, again, I think we're seeing.
Yeah.
In,
the fact...
In our time.
Yeah. So, because of Visser 3's posturing, he created this illusion that the Andalite bandits had died. And so Visser 1 realizes that if she can get the Andalite bandits to show up, which she knows that they're not all Andalites, and she figures out in this book that, like, one of them is an Andalite, and that's it.
I love how she's just totally unwilling to play that. I'm like, you are really smart, lady. You don't ever tell anybody that.
Yeah.
It is never going to be the right time. That is your ultimate card.
Yeah.
And, like, you will almost never need to play that. And she doesn't. I'm like, cool.
Yeah, God bless.
I mean, good for us, obviously, but cool.
Well, that's something as well. So now that we're getting into the Marco territory, that's also sort of how I view the situation with Marco and his mom and our hope and fear as an audience member and sort of keeping that tension. Like, obviously we don't want Marco's mom to die. Like, cause that's the question. Like, if you're writing this book, what do you do at the end? Like, what do you do with Visser 1? And we're really faced with that question, because Visser 1 gets a hold of a cell phone, calls Marco, asks Marco to show up. Marco and the Animorphs do. And they're able to sort of abscond with Visser 1. They set up a hologram and have, like, alone time. And they say, like, we could take you out of here. And admittedly, like, Visser 1, Eva's body is, like, broken and, like, bruised. And, like, she's in really rough shape.
Yeah, they didn't give her any... Because this is immediately after the book where... the Roach book, right? Where they set up that giant trap and they... Basically involves all the Animorphs masquerading as Andalites and having a lot of contact with both the Vissers,
mm-hmm.
and basically to try to trick them into killing each other on that, like, mountaintop, basically.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
And Vissers, they don't find Visser 1's body, they just find, like, Draken Beam scorch marks, and you're supposed to, obviously nobody assumes that she is actually dead because there's no body.
No better.
But Marco obviously doesn't know what happened, and now we see that, oh, like, she was recaptured. They didn't give her any kind of medical help, so she's, like, still burned to shit. She'd been beaten, like, while being captured by Visser 3's forces, like, all this kind of stuff. So, yeah,
speaking,
she's in really bad shape.
Speaking of badasses and champs, like, Eva, we'll get to Eva in a moment. Eva deserves some good talk about her. So, Marco realizes, and Eva realizes, that, like, they can't, this can't happen. Like, they can't free Eva from Idris's clutches, basically, and, like, go live happily ever after. Because what does that entail? In the previous book that we just read, like, 6 months ago, Marco's dad is engaged now. Like, Marco's dad has moved on in a false reality, but it's his reality. It's what he knows to be true.
And Eva wouldn't be able to re-enter society.
Also
obviously.
That.
Everyone on the York side knows who she is. There would be a hit out, basically.
Yes.
She wouldn't be able to just, like, go back to work, because the human world thinks she's dead.
Yes.
And, I mean, you know, every now and then that happens and someone who you think is dead isn't. But
true.
It's usually a big mess.
It's true. It's a lot of paperwork.
She would be in hiding.
She'd probably be living in a Horpidur colony.
Yeah, they would have to devote a lot of energy to keeping her alive.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a mean thing to say, but it's true.
Yeah. And Marco knows that it's just not feasible, and Eva knows that it's not feasible. And so Marco and Eva have a conversation that we get later, because they take Idris out of her head, and then we don't know what the conversation is, but they put Idris back in Eva's head, and then we get sort of the benefit of the conversation, which just made me sad. I think the fact that it came from a third person that is not emotionally in the situation made it sadder for me to, like, read Marco and Eva's conversation. And the fact also that there were two things that I really liked that they did with the characters, sort of fleshing out Marco and Eva. One was that I loved that the characteristic that we know that Marco has of being sort of ruthless and seeing the whole picture and seeing the clear line from A to B, Eva also has. That's sort of a genetic thing. I know. God. And then the other thing that I really loved is that in the very beginning, before we get the testimony, it's a flashback, basically, of Idris as Eva leaving to go on the boat and stage her death and leave behind Marco and his dad. And in that point, Idris sort of says that Marco's really soft, that he's like, too sensitive a child, or like too soft,
yeah.
That he's not like.
He's weak and he's not going to amount to much in human society.
Exactly.
And he definitely wouldn't in York society.
Yes. But that we know that Marco is the most ruthless of all of them. Maybe tying around with Rachel. I think they sort of go neck and neck and past each other at different points and in different ways.
Yeah.
But like, Marco is a ruthless, calculating, strategic dude. That will do what needs to be done. And that we know that the reason he is like this is because of the war. Which is just like, oh. Which just taps into the and it's with Rachel too. It's with all of them. That this is fundamentally changing who they are. They are children. And they are forever, like, altered by this sort of burden.
I found Darwin really sad. I mean,
oh.
for obvious reasons. Darwin being one of the children that Idris / Allison and Hildy / Assam have. They have twins. And because, of course, Visser 3 gets a hold of this boy and uses him as a hostage.
He tries to force
Visser 1 to kill him to prove that she doesn't care about her human children, which is asshole move, just in case you were unclear.
So many asshole cards up the sleeve.
But it's especially sad because the kid is a controller, obviously.
Yeah.
And if you, you know, if you spend as much time thinking about what this pair of human controllers' eventual long game would have been if they had just been allowed to, like, do their thing on Earth, instead of what actually happens, like, and you assumed that, yeah, someday the kids would have been infested, you still have to imagine that it would have turned out a very different kind of controller.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wouldn't have been what we see Darwin being, which is just your run-of-the-mill human controller where the Yerg is totally in control and the human is a slave.
Yeah.
So, it's like, double whammy. Good
job. And it also makes you wonder, like, what the human Darwin, like, knows. Does he know the whole story?
Yeah,
because
he and his sister are adopted. It's not stated whether they're adopted by the same family. Obviously, they would not have grown up with any knowledge of who their real parents are, because one of them dies and the other one becomes homeless.
Oof.
And presumably some level of either perceived insane or actually mentally unwell. The Yerk that is in Darwin, we don't know anything about them.
Yeah.
But there's no reason to believe that they would have any kind of rank or any kind of knowledge of anything.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's not really indicated that Visser 3 told the Darwin controller, like, who Visser 1 is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
no, we have no information about that. And the other twin is still out there somewhere. There's a
girl, Madra.
and she's hopefully alive somewhere. And I don't think this gets brought back up, because this is a one-off book. I can't imagine how it would.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever
come back.
I don't think it's resolved in a future book.
Man, so this is bleak. and it's bleak. Yeah, Marco and Eva are separated again. Eva still has the Yerk in her head. And what ends up happening is Visser 3 and Visser 1 get execution sentences that are immediately suspended, which seems a really ineffectual council move, but whatever. We need them to be alive. They're villains. And Visser 3 is set to continue botching his invasion of Earth.
I found that sort of unbelievable. I'm like,
yeah,
oh, he's like actually bad at his job, guys.
It would be nice if they had introduced, like, you know, we're bringing in somebody to like help you, and it's gonna be like making this difficult for you.
And that might actually be the case in the next book. I honestly don't remember. I do feel like there's other, like, in charge figures who every now and then pop up to like either try to show him how to do things or like make his life difficult. Or basically, like, be the Inquisitor.
Mm.
And then, yeah, Visser 1 is set to... They give her another planet to play with for some reason, basically.
Yeah, they send her off
like,
to
we found this new possible classified species. Why don't you go see about that?
Why
like,
don't you go marry one of them?
Yeah, why don't you go fall in love and get addicted to this species of alien that we theoretically want to use for our own ends? Like, did none of us learn any of these lessons?
No. Well, they talk about, though, that Garoff, who is potentially the council head, is, like, sympathetic to Idris.
Yeah, I mean...
That he gives her... He's pretty lenient with her and gives her opportunities to explain herself and, like, you know, explore that gray area, even though Visser 3 is, like, shrieking next to her that, like, she needs to be executed. Granted, maybe Garoff just is like us and finds Visser 3 awful. And is, like, wanting to stick it to him, which, you know,
fair.
Don't blame him.
Yeah, he really is the only council member who ever talks, though, which,
yeah.
I mean, there's 13 of them, so that was probably a good choice.
And some of them are Taxons.
And some of them are Taxons, and...
Who puts Taxons on a council? Come on, now.
I guess if, like, they're trying to make some attempt at, like, fairness, which just seems totally pointless, considering everything else about their society and their end game.
Seriously, like who are you trying to fool?
Why would you even bother? Nobody who you're talking to is going to give a shit. Although, I mean, you know, there might be some sort of, you know, like, loud tax and political action committee who, like, wants representation. I don't know.
And also just to eat people.
I did find the end a little bit unsatisfying.
Yeah.
And she just about faces really swiftly and is like, yeah, and this time I'll do it right. And I'm like, you won't, though, and at this point I don't think that would be your thought.
That's the thing. I think that's sort of my... sort of watching for the two Idrisses and having her, because it's such a precarious, delicate, like, situation to write, the idea that, like, sometimes Idris is believably working with Eva and Eva is believably helping her, like, mom to mom, and then at other points Idris is, like, not there for, like, human weakness, but she already has demonstrated. And I think also because all of these events of human weakness were in the past, and this is her testimony, like, of course she's also going to sort of, like, overcompensate and try to, like, stick back to the, or get back to the hard line of the party line. But it's kind of jarring to have her flip-flop so quickly.
I mean, it's believable that she would be in such deep denial that she would want that to be true. Like, yes, I know how to not do things this time. Like, I know exactly what all the mistakes that I made. And that the Anathi, or whatever they were called. You know, I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to keep my distance and specifically exploit them and not become friends with them. But especially considering that, you know, she was just on trial. She hasn't eaten it. They can't really... head of lettuce to eat at one point when she's like, dude, I physically have to eat, like, I'm starving and I'm injured and, like, please give me some food. and Mr. You know, you have to wonder whether Mr. Freeze was fucking with her at that point. Or whether, because she's like, see, this is how bad you are at your job. Like, you don't even know what humans need to eat to survive. And I'm like, I really think he's just messing with you, man. Because he's an asshole. Like, yeah, he would give you a head of lettuce and expect you to subsist on that.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the end, if there had just been a couple more lines, I think it...
Yeah.
Because it is super just, it's very abrupt.
Yeah. That is true. I didn't really... I was in the last chapter and didn't know it. And then I kept trying to... Because I actually read this on my phone. Fun fact. It's not that fun. Visitor is the only Animorphs book that I don't own.
Yeah, I don't own it either.
So I had to read it in, like, ebook form. And I was trying to swipe. I was like, go to the next page,
no,
damn it.
There must be more.
And it was like, you're an idiot. It's over. So, yeah. That's where we landed on Visser. Do we have anything else?
No, I think we got to most of the high points, which are...
All sad high points.
Yeah, there's not a lot of light or humor in this book.
No. Maybe the next one, right? Maybe they're gonna get happy and fun again.
Yeah, sure. Someday the Animorphs will be happy again.
Yeah, that's unlikely. Regardless... We thank you for sticking with us and listening to our chatter about Visser. We are also going to record a bonus podcast about Rogue One. So if you also were Star Wars fans as we were, as children, as younger people, and now, look out for that. And we will be coming with you, not with you, we will be coming to you next time to talk about the mutation. Is that correct? Yes.
This one is really weird.
Okay.
Taxidermy.
Okay, that's not what I was expecting you to say.
Taxidermy humans.
Okay, so...
Yeah, it's a strange one.
All right, so we'll be back to talk about The Mutation, which, fun fact, was written in November 1999. So if you just want a good blast from the past, be sure to read that and then check back in with us. Until then, signing off.